gotta be made. I'm overworked and underpaid. I'm overworked and underpaid. I'm overworked and underpaid.
I wonder who that was. That's a great song. Love that slide. My name's Paul Muth. I'm in with the show called, it's not Window on the World, though we're doing international issues since maybe everybody's talking about North Korea. Opinions you hear here are those of the speakers. I've got two Christines. They both work with the Korean Policy Institute. One of them was the founding member of Women Cross DMZ. That's Christine Ahn. There was some talk of having her come to town. She's a Korean-born but now Hawaii resident. Christine Hong, on the contrary, is at Santa Cruz and is quite eloquent. She speaks with Jeremy Scahill at some length. Amy Goodman's commentary on breaking the sound barrier is on the same issue, the Korean situation and the curious reaction of Cold War liberals. With a little outtake from Bruce Cummings out of University of Chicago. I finally heard of him on NPR. I've been tweeting about him for quite a while because he has a dissident view on the issue. He's at University of Chicago. You should look for him, Cummings with one M. And I first encountered him in a book called The Hidden History of the Korean War, which is a collection of I.F. Stone's contemporaneous writings about the Korean War. It's quite an insightful backstory to what was going on at the time, and there's a foreword by Bruce Cummings. So all about that. Obviously there's a lot of other things going on with the U.S. Council of Bishops condemning the ripping the children out of the hands of parents. Been one suicide this week by a distraught Honduran in incarceration. Lamentable. Speaking of overworked and underpaid, the UN Human Rights Commission is going to release a report on the state of poverty in the U.S. What comeuppance? What uppity? I mean, what an uppity group! The U.S. Is pulling out of it over condemnations multiple of Israel. People say that there's an extreme focus on Israel by the UN. Well, the UN had a lot to do with the birth of the situation. Consequently, there's an extra onus on them to react. So it isn't unusual, in my opinion, but it's used as a foil quite a bit. Anyway, I'm going to turn it over to Dennis Bernstein and Jerry Scahill, who are doing the interviewing. There's an anonymous Korean guy in the Bay Area. I'm sure he must be known to KCIA by this point, but he still goes by KJ, doing some work. Interesting fellow from New Zealand. He's in marketing, so maybe he has particular insight on our POTUS. I don't know. He's pretty left for being in marketing. I guess things are different down under in New Zealand. Has a book out about the situation between the U.S. and Korea and China. He's pretty eloquent in this. It's a pretty breathless interview. They had some technical difficulties. I've tried to cut them out. The material from Intercepted is brilliant as usual, in my opinion. Says a lot of it so well. But here's Amy Goodman from some of the reporting she did this week. If you want to look more into the situation with the asylum children being taken away from their parents, completely out of international human rights policies. You can find a lot of on Amy Goodman's democracynow.org website this week. So try to get a few announcements of events coming up. I don't know any off the top of my head. There's a lot of good music going on, as usual. support live and local music. One of the things we do at WEFT is try and SpaghettiOs. I'm having trouble with one of my players here. There we go. Oh, and I've got Zora on deck. Okay. It's one of those mornings. Let's start Amy again, breaking the sound barrier. I'm a little late because I was watching Lionel Messi, and I don't know what happened in extra time. Checking.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. President Donald Trump wrapped up his historic Singapore summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, weathering a barrage of criticism for giving away too much to his adversary and gaining nothing. So much for the art of the deal, Connecticut Democratic Senator Chris Murphy told one news outlet, referencing Trump's 1987 co-authored book touting his business acumen. Many of Trump's Democratic critics, eager to denounce whatever he does, which he so often deserves, sound more bellicose than hawkish neoconservatives. But a growing number of progressive Democrats are willing to support Trump's diplomatic efforts, hoping to avoid war.
Imagine if it weren't Donald Trump there, but if it were Barack Obama there, having that kind of breakthrough. I think there would be a reaction from almost every progressive Democrat cheering that on.
That's Democratic Congressmember Ro Khanna of California speaking on the Democracy Now! NewsHour. Who wouldn't cheer avoiding nuclear war? It was only last September when Trump tweeted, "Just heard Foreign Minister of North Korea speak at UN. If he echoes thoughts of Little Rocket Man, they won't be around much longer," Trump tweeted. In response to threatening comments exchanged between Trump and what he called Little Rocket Man Kim, the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists advanced their doomsday clock to 2 minutes before midnight, their assessment of the relative danger of nuclear war. Started in 1947, the doomsday clock has only been at 2 minutes to midnight once before. In 1953, the year the Soviet Union first detonated a hydrogen bomb, escalating the arms race with the U.S. Hawks like Republican South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham have long encouraged a military assault on North Korea.
If diplomacy fails as a last resort, Democrats and Republicans need to put the military option on the table.
That's Senator Graham speaking last Sunday as President Trump was en route to Singapore. More concerning is newly appointed National Security Advisor John Bolton, who wrote last February, "It's perfectly legitimate for the United States to respond to the current necessity posed by North Korea's nuclear weapons by striking first." Bolton was invoking the doctrine of necessity of preemptive attack in self-defense, just as he did before the 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq on the false pretense that Saddam Hussein possessed weapons of mass destruction.
There isn't any military solution on the Korean Peninsula.
That's University of Chicago history professor Bruce Cummings, one of the world's leading Korea scholars, speaking on Democracy Now!
For the first time in a long time, there's a thaw between Pyongyang and Washington. And to talk about going to war if this thaw doesn't work, it's just reprehensible.
Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, wrote a letter to the president, co-signed by six other senators, demanding that Trump maintain negotiating positions that most experts agree are simply unachievable. These include the complete, verifiable, irreversible denuclearization, or CVID, that's C-V-I-D, of North Korea, without comparable concessions from the U.S. to diminish its military presence on the Korean Peninsula.
My disagreement with Senator Schumer in that letter is that's basically parroting the talking points of John Bolton.
Again, California Congressmember Ro Khanna.
Saying that we should not engage in any diplomacy or make any concessions without complete denuclearization. That's just not realistic.
Congressman Khanna also sent the president a letter co-signed by 14 Democratic members of Congress rebutting his Senate colleagues.
A far more realistic framework is an incremental approach where we need to ask for the cessation of testing and make concessions on an incremental basis. And that's what I think has begun with this process.
Christine Ahn is the founder of Women Cross DMZ. That's the demilitarized zone between North and South Korea, a global movement of women mobilizing to end the Korean War. She's organized women-led marches across the DMZ, most recently 2 weeks ago. On the eve of that march, she said on Democracy Now!,
"The people of North and South Korea want very much peace to prevail on the Korean Peninsula, and I think that's our role as the international community, especially from the United States."
On Tuesday, just after the Singapore summit, Christine Ahn added,
"Peace is in the air, and we have a lot of work to do, especially as a peace movement in this country."
People have been organizing since long before Trump to end the 70-year state of war on the Korean Peninsula. The importance of the election of South Korea's president, Moon Jae-in, cannot be overstated. A mass movement drove his predecessor from office and carried Moon, who openly advocated for peace with North Korea, into power. Famously mercurial, President Trump canceled the U.S.-North Korea summit once, only to reinstate it soon after. He could easily derail the peace process again. In the United States, Democrats and Republicans should unite behind the peace movements that are driving this diplomatic opening. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
And there'll be more of trying to persuade you that that might be the attitude to take. I'm guardedly, very guardedly optimistic that maybe the pressure from the South Koreans will sustain this opening. It isn't a Trump initiative at all. Though it was interesting to note, and I haven't heard it anywhere else but on Flashpoints, that the South Korean president wanted to come to Singapore, but the Trump administration and maybe Trump himself didn't want to share the spotlight. Or were there other reasons that they didn't want him there? I don't know. Would have been a logical thing to do, it seems. We'll see whether any of the other four parties involved in the Korean War will be there in future negotiations, which means China as well. Speaking of ICE and immigration issues, there's going to be a demonstration a week from today at Drury Inn Hotel. It's up off North Prospect, proximate to what I understand, and I don't have the details on it, of some Homeland Security facility that's right up that way. So maybe they will continue to house there, even though they know there's a demonstration coming. I don't know. There's a planning meeting for that event tomorrow at 2 o'clock at the IMC. So that's on the progressive calendar list here, and I think it's a worthy venture. Let's get right on with another great Intercepted. This one includes Christine Hong, H-O-N-G, Santa Cruz professor, not Christine Ahn, which is A-H-N, if I recall. But we'll hear from her from Flashpoints fairly straight away. Leaving this Brooklyn-related announcement on about Cy Hirsch doing an Intercepted live next Thursday night. I assume I'll probably have some of that next week. I'm anxious to hear how wide-ranging his book chat on his memoir is called Reporter. Will be. The ones I have heard are not very contemporary. They go into a lot of his history and about how he threw a typewriter out of the window over editorial judgment against him, publishing something. He came back to clear out his desk and find the typewriter was there, replaced, and nobody said anything about his throwing the typewriter out of the window. Not one of the more informative, but kind of a neat anecdote about self-censorship by the editorial staff in a lot of organizations. Okay, here's that announcement about Cy Hirsch, and then we'll go right into another collage of audio. It's not hard to lampoon Trump these days, and it's a worthy effort, I think. As long as one realizes how serious things are developing.
Here, what are some of the highlights? Set it up for us.
Yes, so as we all know, there was a meeting between...
That's the next segment, I'm sorry. That was KJ and Dennis Bernstein, but here's...
Exposed the My Lai massacre, Richard Nixon's domestic spy program, and he helped bring down a president with his journalism. Decades later, Hirsch blew the lid off of the torture at Abu Ghraib. Now, he's written his memoir, Reporter.
Was anybody more of a gangster than some of the leading people who conducted the wars we had? We had gangsters all of our life in our society. And they, some of them were senators, and some of them were, you know, secretaries of defense, were some murderous people.
On Thursday, June 21st, Cy Hirsch will be our special guest at a live show of Intercepted, taking place at the Music Hall of Williamsburg in New York. We'll also be joined by the lead ACLU attorney fighting the Trump and ICE deportation and family separation machine, and by educator and prison abolitionist Mariam Kaba.
Especially if you're liberal and progressive, stop calling for people to be locked up every day. Everybody shouldn't be going to prison. That's the point. Stop playing into those ideas that every time something happens, your first inclination is to think about the prosecution and court system as the way to solve that problem.
The evening will also feature a live performance from the Iraqi-Canadian hip-hop artist, Narsi. Intercepted Live, Thursday, June 21st at 7 p.m. at the Music Hall of Williamsburg. For tickets, log on to theintercept.com/tickets. That's theintercept.com/tickets. I don't even think my country love me back.
Free. I think within the first minute, I'll know. Just my touch, my feel. That's what I do. You know, the way they say that you know if you're going to like somebody in the first 5 seconds? You ever hear that one? Something good is going to happen.
All right, Charlie. Neighborhood of make-believe.
It's my honor today to address the people of the world following this very historic summit with Chairman Kim Jong-un of North Korea.
If you can do something with angry feelings, then you don't have to feel so angry anymore.
Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself and for his regime.
There are many healthy things you can do with your anger, things that don't hurt anybody.
We will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea.
Let's have some make-believe now.
Be nice. Be respectful. I don't want to be threatening.
Getting to be friends is like building bridges.
We had a great conversation. It was a very heartfelt conversation. I did it because nuclear is always number one to me. Nuclear is number one.
Some people think that friends are always happy.
That's what I do. My whole life has been deals. I've done great at it.
Always having fun.
We call them war games, and I call them war games, and they're tremendously expensive. We fly in bombers from Guam. I know a lot about airplanes.
Well, that's not true. Friends often have hard times and sad times.
I haven't slept in 25 hours, but I may be wrong. I mean, I may stand before you in 6 months and say, hey.
But friends can come together again and again and build a stronger and stronger friendship between each other.
As an example, they have great beaches. You see that whenever they're exploding their cannons into the ocean, right? They really enjoyed it, I believe, okay? So I'm gonna head back. I don't know about you folks, but it's been a long time since I've taken it easy.
Please won't you be my neighbor?
You never know, right? We never know.
This is Intercepted. I'm Jeremy Scahill coming to you from the offices of The Intercept in New York City, and this is episode 60 of Intercepted.
And I'm doing something that I've wanted to do from the beginning. We stopped playing those war games that cost us a fortune. You know, we're spending a fortune every number of months. We're doing war games with South Korea. And I said, what's this costing? We're flying planes in from Guam and we're bombing empty mountains for practice. And I said, I want to stop that and I will stop that. And I think it's very provocative, especially, George, since we're getting along. In other words, we're in the process.
The bipartisan war party is in panic mode. The longest continuous war on the planet, the Korean War, may be on the path to ending. Donald Trump is certainly one of the most unreliable, untrustworthy, and just plain awful people to be in the command chair for this. But to paraphrase Donald Rumsfeld, you hope for peace with the president you have, not the one you want. I punished myself during the Trump-Kim summit by watching U.S. cable news. I bounced from CNN to Fox to MSNBC and on and on and on. Fox, of course, was on its own planet cheering on Trump because Fox is a privatized version of state media.
How political opponents of the president are purposely trying to create artificial, unrealistic expectations so that they could, this is a failure, when we've gotten so much out of this already before it even started. No one predicted that these talks would immediately result in the complete and total denuclearization of North Korea. This is going to be a process, as the secretary...
The hypocrisy was certainly thick on Fox News, which has consistently, for years, agitated for obliterating North Korea. Its pundits ridiculed Barack Obama for suggesting that he might be willing to meet with the leaders of North Korea or Iran. But you know what? Hypocrisy sometimes has its virtues. If Trump can make Fox News get on the side of peace in Korea, we should all take that. But on the respectable networks, CNN and MSNBC, there was a lot of this.
Just having parity. Look at the North Korean flags right next to the American flag. I mean, whoever thought we would see that?
Of the two flags together is diminishing to the U.S. side. Let's take
it. In fact, I would say it's somewhat disgusting. It is actually a debasement of the American flag. This is a despotic regime that murders its own citizens. And so we're putting him on the same stage as the American president. Now, hopefully, it will serve.
The North Koreans want to be treated as equals. Gasp! The American flag next to North Korea's? The horror. And the conventional wisdom repeated by many, many pundits was that Trump was giving away the war farm. The message Trump sent by ripping up the Iran deal and then immediately meeting with the North Korean leader sent a message to the world that achieving nuclear weapons status protects you and prevents you from going the way of Muammar Gaddafi in Libya. Now, I don't deny that that is part of the message. At the same time, what about the context of all of this? Why did North Korea pursue nuclear weapons in the first place? Was it to be a global menace? Was it to change the regime in the United States? Or was it because of the threats from the U.S. and its allies? The U.S. committed systematic war crimes against North Korea in the 1950s. Nearly 3 million people were killed in that war, the overwhelming majority of them Koreans. The U.S. conducted scorched earth bombing, wiped out entire cities, used napalm and other chemical weapons. The U.S. refused to recognize a North Korean government. It has regularly, for decades, threatened to invade North Korea, overthrow its government, obliterate the country, wipe it off the map. The U.S. stages nuclear war games, has 30,000 troops positioned on North Korea's border. And that war, the Korean War, is still not officially over. And the reason it's not over is largely because of the posture and actions of the United States.
The communist system to the North is based on hatred and depression. It brutally attacks every form of human liberty and declares those who worship God to be enemies of the people.
The United States condemns this provocative act. Once again, North Korea has defied the will of the international community, and the international community will respond.
The regime in North Korea must know they will only achieve security and prosperity by meeting their international obligations. Provocations of the sort we saw last night will only further isolate them. As we stand by our allies, strengthen our own missile defense, and lead the world in taking firm action in response to these threats.
The problem is that in U.S. media, the world is almost always presented through the lens of America first, American exceptionalism. And that necessitates buying into the lie that the United States is actually an honest broker, the human rights respecter, the leader of the free world. As journalist Alan Nairn observed on Twitter, quote, "The establishment Democrats and MSNBC have achieved the remarkable feat of coming across as more militaristic than both Trump and Kim Jong-un." Here's retired Admiral James Stavridis, the former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO forces and one of the names that was floated back in the 2016 election campaign as a possible Hillary Clinton running mate. Here he is speaking to Rachel Maddow on MSNBC, defending U.S. imperialism and actually attacking Trump for suggesting that he might withdraw U.S. troops from Korea.
Our troops are there not as an act of goodwill to South Korea. They're there to enhance U.S. influence in the region, to ensure that we keep those sea lanes of communication open, that our trade can flow freely, that we have a voice in the events there, for the exact same reason that we still have about 50,000 troops in Europe. They're not there as an act of goodwill. They're there to accomplish U.S. national security objectives. So we draw them down at risk to those objectives, and it is very short-sighted to say, oh, yeah, this will be a twofer. We can reduce tension and save some money by getting our troops off the peninsula. Not the right way to think about this one.
Add to these types of statements that were made on MSNBC, the discredited never-Trumpers and neocons and others and the parade of former heads of the CIA and the DNI, and you get a good sense of what I mean when I say the war party. In reality, throughout history, the U.S. has been the aggressor toward North Korea. I defended Barack Obama when he said he would meet with leaders of countries we are told are our enemies. I defended him when he said he would do it even without precondition. I believe that's one of the only ways we can actually achieve any meaningful peace in this world.
Chairman Kim has told me that North Korea is already destroying a major missile engine testing site. That's not in your signed document. We agreed to that after the agreement was signed. That's a big thing. For the missiles that they were testing, the site is going to be destroyed very soon.
If Donald Trump can fumble and misspeak his way through a process that leads to an ending of the Korean War, that's a good thing, regardless of the character of the man responsible for kickstarting the process. Who are we to stand in the way of the wishes of a majority of people on the Korean peninsula? More than 80% of South Koreans supported Trump's summit with Kim. Even more South Koreans back their own president, Moon Jae-in. There are even some polls indicating that as much as 70% of the American public supported Trump meeting with Kim. The people who seem most passionately against this process are the Democrats and Republicans who constitute the war party. Yes, there are some dissenting Democrats. But what about the leaders?
Senator Chuck Schumer is now threatening more sanctions. Neocons are high-fiving the establishment Democrats over their common position that boils down to supporting hostility, hard lines, and ultimately a continuation of the world's longest-running war.
Any agreement between the United States and North Korea must be permanent. Let us hope this isn't the final chapter in diplomacy with Pyongyang. President Trump and his team must take stock of what's happened, what North Korea has achieved, what we have yet to achieve, and pursue again a tougher course.
Let's stop with all the pearl clutching over Trump meeting with a dictator. U.S. presidents do that all the time. Look at the disgusting love fest we were subjected to recently when Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, visited Washington. Heinous, anti-democratic, human rights abusing monarchy. Or the Egyptian dictator, General Sisi. The U.S. meets with dictators all the time. And worse, it gives them weapons, intelligence, aid. It normalizes them in front of the world. Let's not act like any of these objections are really based on improving human rights for the hundreds of thousands of North Koreans in labor camps or dungeons, or the hundreds of thousands of others who have no basic human rights. Americans need to take off the exceptionalism goggles. We need to understand that the people who have the most to gain or lose from all of this are ordinary Koreans, and they overwhelmingly want this war to end. That's what matters here. With Moon Jae-in in power in South Korea, that peninsula has its best chance in decades to end a war that the United States played a central role in starting and continuing. Yes, Trump is a clown. He made an ass of himself on multiple occasions at this summit.
Getting a good picture, everybody, so we look nice and handsome.
Beautiful.
Perfect.
Trump publicly shared his dreams of opening resorts and hotels in North Korea.
They have great beaches. You see that whenever they're exploding their cannons into the ocean, right? So I said, boy, look at that. Wouldn't that make a great condo behind? And I explained, I said, you know, instead of doing that, you could have the best hotels in the world right there. Think of it from a real estate perspective. You have South Korea, you have China, and they own the land in the middle. How bad is that, right? It's great.
At the same time Trump was making these ridiculous statements, he also spoke some truth about the U.S. hostility toward North Korea.
It's a very provocative situation. When I see that, and you have a country right next door. So under the circumstances that we're negotiating a very comprehensive, complete deal, I think it's inappropriate to be having war games.
In a way, this reminds me of that now infamous interview, you've heard it a few times on this show, that Trump did with Bill O'Reilly, where he said, there are a lot of killers in the world.
A lot of killers. We got a lot of killers. Why, you think our country's so innocent?
Sometimes Donald Trump is accidentally right, often for the wrong reasons. But if he can pull all U.S. troops from South Korea, that's a good thing, especially if it's done with the support and counsel and involvement of President Moon. The U.S. has tried belligerence. It's tried threats. It's tried permanent war. It's tried apocalyptic wargaming. Now let's try something different. Let's actually defer to Koreans on what they want and how they believe this war can finally end and how they believe that the real threats can be eliminated. At the end of the day, Trump is sort of a means to an end for many Koreans who have spent their lives fighting to end the scourge of war, fighting to be reunified with their families. It's not our place to stand in the way. Joining me now to discuss the Trump-Kim summit is Christine Hong. She is associate professor at UC Santa Cruz and an executive board member of the Korea Policy Institute. Christine, welcome to Intercepted.
Thank you.
First, just your reaction. What is the significance of not only this meeting, but the document that they signed?
You know, I mean, a lot of people are saying in the media that this document is really flimsy. But I have to say that this is historically momentous. Never before has a sitting U.S. president had a meeting with the North Korean head of state. And so even in terms of the symbolism of it all, it's hugely important. But the other thing that happened was that Donald Trump actually made some pretty serious structural concessions. And so this is just to back up a little bit. In the lead up to the summit, North Korea took a number of good faith measures. Not only did North Korea release three Korean Americans who were imprisoned in North Korea for committing hostile acts, but also destroyed its nuclear testing site in Punggye-ri. It effectively placed a moratorium on all of its nuclear testing.
I'm here at North Korea's nuclear test site at Punggye-ri, a place that foreign journalists have never been allowed before, and we are here, the North Korean government says, to witness the destruction of this site. They say it will never be able to be used again.
And so we should realize that throughout the Barack Obama presidency, North Korea put forth a measure which has been wrongly attributed in the mainstream media to China and Russia of a freeze for a freeze proposal. And it proposed to the United States during the Obama administration that if the United States suspended its large-scale war games with its ally South Korea, that North Korea was willing to suspend its nuclear testing. And we have to understand what these war exercises are. Chuck Hagel, under Barack Obama, who claimed that these war exercises were just business as usual. And these war exercises, which are staged annually, they're the largest in the world. They simulate the invasion and occupation of North Korea. They simulate a nuclear first strike against North Korea. And they also practice the decapitation of North Korea's leadership. And we cannot imagine the United States being fine with Cuba and Russia conducting these kinds of war exercises off the United States coast. And historically, North Korea has said these are incredibly provocative. They're just a hair's breadth away from the actual prosecution of war. The United States has poo-pooed these kinds of claims. All of a sudden, we see Donald Trump in a kind of tit-for-tat measure, meeting good faith measure with good faith measure, indicating that he's willing to suspend these war games, and he actually called them provocative.
When I was watching Kim Jong-un act somewhat deferential to Donald Trump and then talking to Korean friends, what I learned was that what Kim Jong-un was doing is actually the culturally appropriate manner to behave with someone who is older than you. And I was so impressed by Kim Jong-un's statement when he sat down with Trump and was speaking, where he said, "It has not been easy to come to this point. For us, the past has been holding us back, and old practices and prejudices have been covering our eyes and ears, but we've been able to overcome everything to arrive here today." If that was an accurate translation of what he said, that is more articulate than any sentence Trump has ever uttered, probably in his life.
I mean, you're absolutely right. There is a kind of respect for one's elders that is part and parcel of Korean culture, whether you're from the North or the South. And you could say that when Kim Jong-un met with Moon Jae-in, the president of South Korea, you could see similar sort of patterns and, you know, a kind of behavior of respect toward one's elder. You know, when Kim Jong-un was speaking, he was speaking as the head of a society that has only known one policy from the United States, and that has been an unceasing policy of regime change. And we have to recall that, you know, he's sitting across from the person who threatened just last year to rain down fire and fury like the world has never seen before on North Korea.
"They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen."
Who stood before the United Nations, you know, stated that he was willing to totally destroy North Korea. Of course, you know, human rights experts who were there in the audience understood this to be a crucial statement of intention, which is essential for understanding the legal definition of genocide. And so they're sitting across from someone who didn't seem to have any historical awareness, who actually had the prerogative and the privilege of amnesia with regard to what the United States actually did to North Korea in the middle part of the 20th century, which is to say that the United States, which commanded control of the skies over the Korean Peninsula, rained down fire and fury like the world had never seen before on North Korea.
And of course, as you well know, Christine, at the time of the what is called the Korean War, there were a half a dozen to 16 or 17 cities that had been established in what is now North Korea, and all of them were entirely obliterated by the United States. The U.S. was by far the greatest aggressor in that war. 70% of North Koreans killed in that war were civilians. And as I watched the media coverage in the United States, you would think that the opposite was true. You would think that it is North Korea that has been threatening regime change, that it was North Korea that had committed massive war crimes against the United States. And there were war crimes committed against U.S. personnel. But my God, who was the greatest victim of that war? Ordinary North Koreans. Who was the great aggressor of that war? The United States.
Absolutely. I mean, you bring up a number of really critical points. You know, I mean, the fact of the matter is that North Korea, to borrow a phrase from Arundhati Roy, is a country that was sculpted from the spare rib of America's aggressive foreign policy. And we have to recall, like, you know, you're saying, like 70% of the Koreans who were killed, North or South, during that the hot fighting period of what we call the Korean War, were civilians, as you said. And with regard to North Korea, the estimates are staggering. I mean, there was nothing left to bomb. That's what the bombers actually stated. Civilian infrastructure was totally taken out. That's against the laws of war. And, you know, on Pyongyang alone, that was a city that only had 400,000 occupants at that time. The United States unleashed over 420,000 bombs on that city. That's more than one per person. That's the very definition of overkill. This is what the historian Bruce Cummings calls a bombing holocaust. You cannot go to North Korea and meet anyone whose family wasn't personally impacted by the aggressive war violence of the Korean War, that at the Nuremberg trials and also in the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, the crime of crimes held above genocide, held above crimes against humanity, is aggressive war or war against the peace. This is a kind of crime that powers that are historically imperialist, including the United States, these wars of intervention are almost always crimes against the peace, but there is a culture of impunity about them.
How long has that bipartisan sort of love affair with the idea of total destruction of Korea been in place?
We're stretching back to Truman. We're talking about Truman, who, as an explicit part of his war policy against North Korea, slapped sanctions 3 days into the Korean War on North Korea. We're talking about Truman, who entertained the possibility of nuclear annihilation, you know, against North Korea multiple times. The United States has threatened North Korea with nuclear annihilation on countless occasions. So I would say that the apocalyptic American imagination toward North Korea, it goes back decades. And if we're going to talk about sort of more recent times, I mean, you could just see that recently it was something like 7 Democratic senators issued a statement protesting Donald Trump's efforts to sort of move from war footing, fire and fury footing, to peace footing. And there's something so incredibly ridiculous about this. When you're talking about this bipartisan consensus, I mean, we have to recognize that Trump has a businessman's approach to the military-industrial complex, and there are structural contradictions that complicate the prospect of peace even being realized. One of them is the fact that Trump has basically an austerity program when it comes to any kind of social spending. He, like his predecessor Barack Obama, supports the trillion-plus dollar renovation of America's nuclear arsenal. All of these things make the prospect of meaningful denuclearization as something that is a reciprocal obligation complicated. You know, Barack Obama, who came into office promising that he would reach out a hand if America's historic foes uncurled their fists. And he's, you know, did so, you know, we could say to some degree with regard to Iran and Cuba. But with regard to North Korea, he maintained a studiously hard line. So let's get cynical and ask why that was. Well, actually, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, his Secretary of State, viewed the Asia-Pacific region as the signature arena of their foreign policy. And their foreign policy was a pivot policy to Asia and the Pacific. And what it entailed was, you know, in viewing Asia as America's economic future, this is a very old imperialist fantasy, you know, they basically authorized the relocation of 60% of American naval power from the Atlantic to the Pacific. And they basically, like almost every single document that was released by the Pentagon, authorizing accelerated weapon sales, any kind of agreement that was made between the United States and its regional allies for bilateral, lateral, trilateral, multilateral war exercises, any kind of deployment of any kind of military defense system, the stationing of nuclear aircraft carriers, et cetera, all of that was done during the Barack Obama era in the name of a hostile and nuclear-armed North Korea.
Just to add to that, and yeah. Chuck Schumer, the leader of the Democrats mm-hmm. in the Senate, released a very belligerent statement threatening more sanctions and denouncing the Trump-Kim summit.
It doesn't surprise me at all. So there's this kind of liberal consensus around the prospect of war with North Korea. And so interestingly enough, we have this kind of situation in which North Korea, which had no possible room for maneuver in terms of diplomacy, because there was no diplomatic channel as an option during the Obama era, it basically took to the pathway of a nuclear deterrent. And let's recall that also during the George W. Bush era, North Korea was placed on a short axis of evil list of permissible nuclear first strikes.
States like these and their terrorist allies constitute an axis of evil, arming to threaten the peace of the world. By seeking weapons of mass destruction, these regimes pose a grave and growing danger.
So from the Axis of Evil era to Barack Obama, North Korea has not been able to come out of the cold. Interestingly enough, Trump, who has an ego investment in reversing his predecessor's policies, is actually, and even on the campaign trail, there's a certain kind of consistency. He's been open to the prospect of some kind of hamburger diplomacy with North Korea. And of course, as you're saying, why isn't this a good thing? The other thing that I'm going to mention, too, is that you mentioned this kind of cynical use of human rights. You know, the fact of the matter is, let's be real about how that human rights industry consolidated around North Korea. You know, in the post-Cold War era, these organizations that had, during the late Cold War period, brought defectors from the socialist bloc to the United States. And, you know, the legal scholar Samuel Moyne states that in the late Cold War period, what happened was U.S. human rights as a state discourse was basically anti-communism by another name. And so these kinds of, like, Cold Warrior institutions were renovated as human rights institutions. And under the axis of evil policy of George W. Bush, they took a very hard line. And what do they advocate for? These so-called human rights organizations, and there was a bipartisan consensus, it was, you know, Democrats and Republicans alike, they were basically advocating for fortified sanctions, sanctions that were meant at targeting the livelihood of people, right? I mean, these you know, sanctions are not meant as a surgical blow against the leadership of any country. They're meant as a sort of general destabilizing strategy, soft war strategy that's aimed at making life so unlivable that in theory, they might rise up against their leadership. And so basically, sanctions are a humanitarian catastrophe.
When you look at sanctions that target leaders or powerful business people in countries, those kinds of economic sanctions are, in fact, targeted at powerful people. But the kind of sanctions that you're talking about and that were applied to North Korea, as they've been applied to Iran, as they were applied to murderous effect in Iraq, the idea is a strangulation policy, and it's totally bankrupt. It's the bankruptcy of the entire Cuba policy, too. The idea you can starve, blackmail, threaten, punish people into rising up. There's no evidence that that is an effective policy, and a lot of evidence that it's actually a criminal policy.
So-called human rights advocates, in their desire to ascribe singular blame to the North Korean leadership, they never take into consideration hostile war policy and how that impacts the livelihood of North Korean people.
Well, and of course, we saw John Bolton, who has been one of the absolute most belligerent Americans on earth toward North Korea. When Kim Jong-chol visited the White House recently, one of the most senior and high-ranking officials in North Korea, John Bolton, we understand, was not allowed into that meeting. But Bolton certainly was sitting there with Trump and Kim Jong-un. And there was some speculation that both he and Mike Pence sought to derail this whole process by raising the specter of Libya and engaging in somewhat outright hawkish rhetoric. But does it concern you that there seems to be this radical disconnect? You have Trump, who seems to be going in one direction, and then you have John Bolton, who is his national security advisor and one of the most sort of villainous hawks, pugnacious individuals in the world on North Korea.
Also seated at that table was Choe Sun-hee, who is North Korea's foreign minister. And what she stated in a statement that actually just sort of enraged initially Donald Trump was basically that Mike Pence was a political dummy and that the discussion of, you know, the Libya model was meant to derail any sort of discussion of denuclearization and peace. The fact of the matter, though, is if we were to put ourselves in North Korea's shoes, who would you rather have at the negotiating table? Would you rather have someone who has no power whatsoever, like Rex Tillerson, who doesn't command the confidence of the American president? Or would you rather actually have your worst possible enemy? You know, and North Korea in just recent weeks has actually referred to Bolton as repellent, you know, a kind of characterization that I think that many Americans would agree with. But they would rather have that repellent member of Trump's war cabinet there at the peace table than someone who can't make anything happen.
Right. And the role of Moon Jae-in is very seldom discussed or gone into in detail in U.S. news coverage that I've seen. I mean, I was up all night during the summit watching this, and it seems to me that Moon Jae-in should be getting a tremendous amount of the credit for even getting to the world to a point where an American president can be talking to the leader of North Korea, something that has face-to-face, something that has never happened in the history of these two countries.
This is not the first time that we've seen the leaders of the two Koreas when there's been a liberal in the Blue House in Seoul. It's not the first time that we've seen an attempt by the leaders of Korea to actually effect some kind of rapprochement, to effect some kind of reconciliation, to actually march toward peace, only to be stymied and obstructed by the United States. So there's always been this triangulated relationship. And let's keep in mind that South Korea is semi-sovereign at best. In times of heightened war crisis, South Korea actually doesn't even command its own military forces. They go under the command control of the United States. Also, according to the terms of the Korean War Armistice Agreement, all foreign powers were supposed to remove their forces within a reasonable window of time. China removed its forces within about 5 years' time. The United States, to this day, stations roughly 30,000 forces south of the DMZ. It operates approximately 80 military installations. According to a series of mutual defense treaties and a status of forces agreement, the United States can, at whim and at will, use any South Korean base. And so South Korea is really semi-sovereign at best, but we see the South Korean leader moving forward as a proponent of peace, and we have to ask why. Well, we have to realize that his neoconservative, corrupt, and neoliberal predecessor, who basically wielded this draconian national security law in South Korea against the South Korean people, who basically pushed through a series of neoliberal policies that placed the South Korean people, their lives at risk, made them vulnerable en masse, and who also, in lockstep with Barack Obama, who was friends with every single hawk in the Asia-Pacific region, actually maintained a hardline posture toward North Korea. What happened was the South Korean people in 2016 took to the streets in millions in these candlelight protests. protests. They filled the streets and they called for her ouster.
The place is packed here in downtown Seoul. There are people of all ages. You have families, you have children, you have a remarkably large amount of high school students and university students. And then, of course, going all the way up to the elderly. So all ages, but just one simple message, down with Park.
She was ousted. She's now sitting in prison. And in the snap election, Moon Jae-in was elected. He was elected to push for peace. He has an 85% approval rating in South Korea for his North Korea policy. When Donald Trump was even entertaining the possibility of a bloody nose strike against North Korea, when he was entertaining the possibility of any kind of military option toward North Korea, South Koreans also understood that any anti-North Korea policy on the part of the United States and any military option is effectively an anti-Korean policy. And it would mean, you know, it's basically a kind of policy that demonstrates that Korean lives don't matter. So, you know, Moon Jae-in has the popular authority, unlike this wave of right-wing populism that you see around the world. He actually has progressive populist authority to push for peace. And so the thing that I think is important to watch for is that a number of South Korean labor unions have come forward. And what they've stated is that it's not enough for the leadership of the Koreas to declare a kind of peace process, but that the peace process has to involve workers, and that workers are essential to any kind of vision of reunification and peace.
Christine, thank you so much for the work you've done and for joining us on Intercepted.
It was a pleasure.
Christine Hong is associate professor at UC Santa Cruz. She's also an executive board member of the Korea Policy Institute.
And that was Jeremy Scahill from the latest episode of The Intercepted. Next Thursday, they're having a session that includes Cy Hirsch. I've heard some book chats and really want to get to his ouster from The New Yorker and or ignoring by The New Yorker, and how he had to go to the London Review of Books for his really explosive articles that still haven't had any impact on the discourse here in the U.S. I mentioned a couple of PSAs, community service announcements, I like to call them. There's a talk here at Spurlock Museum, Holy Alliance, the Influence of Religion at the University of Illinois. John Rank will talk about some of this history. In the first 26 years, university students were required to attend Christian chapel every morning, I guess it would be. Practice was challenged by a student suspended for failure to attend. So he has that history. I think there's a history of the English as a second language unit being basically a creature of the missionary zeal that was regnant at the time, a civilizing impulse, as it were, noblesse oblige. Anyway, I do want to get on with the next feature, which features Christine Ahn, A-H-N, not Christine Hong. I was conflating them for a while, so don't do that. I'm going to go over KJ's segment that's on this Flashpoint from Tuesday. And, okay, we're about there. And this should close the hour. Doug Henwood with Behind the News. Maybe he's out on holiday or something. He's got a repeat of the Greek finance minister, Varoufakis. I believe that's his name. That's coming up in the next hour. I think Gene will be in to do continuity with that, perhaps. But here's Dennis Bernstein introducing his guests, I hope, and Christine Ahn, and a New Zealander who's actually a business marketer but has books about North Korea that are pretty insightfully titled.
Give us a call. But joining us first, and we're delighted to have both of them, is Tim Beal. Tim Beal is an expert on East Asian politics, economy, and geopolitics. He is a former professor of Victoria University of Wellington in New Zealand, as well as the founding director of the Center for Asia Pacific Law and Business, and is the author of two highly acclaimed books on Korea, Crisis in Korea, America, China, and the Risk of War, and also North Korea, the Struggle Against American Power. Tim Beal, welcome to Flashpoints.
Hello. Yes. Good to be here.
Good to have you with us. And also joining us is Christine Ahn. Christine Ahn is the founder and international coordinator of Women Across the DMZ, a global movement of women mobilizing to end the Korean War, reunite families, and ensure women's leadership in peace building. And they have been instrumental in calling attention to the need for this kind of discussion and really fighting to end, finally, the Korean War. Christine Ahn, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Thank you, Dennis.
Well, it's good to have you with us. Let me start with you, Christine, your initial response. And were you surprised that Trump told the truth about what those exercises were really about?
I mean, it was extraordinary to hear some of the things that he had said as if he was taking talking points from the Korea Peace Network or some other group that, you know, I have been a part of. And to use terms such as war games and to say that they are provocative. I mean, you know, that is in many ways the genius of Donald Trump is in his unhingedness. There is, you know, this he can't be scripted. And so it was amazing. And that, you know, he was saying that this costs U.S. taxpayers so much money. And, you know, it's extraordinary to me. I'm in Washington, D.C. right now. I've been walking the halls of Congress with about 100 activists from 20 states from across the United States and Hawaii to come together on this day, the morning after the June 12th summit. And, you know, we visited many Democrats. And it was just extraordinary to me to hear that, you know, this alleged party of peace. And I'm saying, with the exception of people like Barbara Lee and Bernie Sanders and Ro Khanna and Tulsi Gabbard, you know, it's just the establishment of the Democratic Party was so deflating. When here we are, we have a situation of a 70-year conflict. This is where 4 million people died, over 30,000 U.S. troops, you know, millions of Korean civilians. And, you know, that war ended in a stalemate, and a ceasefire was signed with a commitment by the military generals to come back and negotiate a peace agreement. And that promise has not been fulfilled. And here we are on the precipice of a historic breakthrough that could reset the dial in terms of U.S. and North Korea relations. And, you know, the Democrats are coming to the right of Donald Trump. It's like I'm just having this kind of surreal moment.
The Democratic minority leader, Chuck Schumer, was like, this was downright dangerous.
Oh, I know. I mean, they sent a letter last week with all these ridiculous preconditions. And, you know, the truth is, I mean, North Korea advanced its nuclear capability the most under the Obama administration. The Obama administration and the Democrat hawks did nothing. They might have done good to normalize relations with Cuba and succeeded in the Iran deal. They let the North Korean situation just languish. And here we have a situation now where the Trump administration and President Trump, for his own narcissistic reasons, but to be honest with you, I mean, you know, I'm obviously a feminist and a longtime progressive, and it has been impossible for me to listen to more than a few minutes of Donald Trump. But when I hear him talk about Korea, it's almost as if he has allowed himself actually, it's almost like he's a child, like listening for the first time. Oh my God, we're still at war with North Korea. We never signed a peace agreement. There's just a ceasefire. The millions of families are divided. We have a responsibility to end this war. This is good. Donald Trump, this is a good thing. And we clearly oppose everything else that he stands for and is doing. But let's not let partisan politics get in the way of something that is hugely important, not just for the Korean Peninsula, but for U.S. and for dialing back the militarization and the justification for the massive militarization by the U.S. in the Asia Pacific.
All right, Tim Beal, I would love to get to your impressions, some of the things that stay with you. Were you surprised the way this unfolded?
Well, not entirely. I mean, I think I take Christine's very good point about the genius of Donald Trump.
The genius, okay.
What the French, I think, would call a wise idiot. He sort of says things which presidents are not supposed to say, and yet which, of course, are quite correct, like the war games. War games, of course, are provocative. They're meant to be provocative. They have various purposes. Provocation is one of them. They're there to drain the North Korean economy, because every time they have these huge war games, the military has to go on to alert, and that's very expensive. Donald Trump talks about expense, but of course it's far more important for the Koreans. So he said all these various things, that they are provocative, whereas, of course, the standard line, as Christine pointed out, is that they are said to be routine and offensive. Now, routine, of course, is meaningless, because you can commit a crime routinely. You can beat your wife every Friday night and say, well, it's just routine, but that doesn't excuse you. And, of course, they're not defensive, because the United States is hundreds of times more powerful than North Korea. So, Trump sort of stumbled on this, and he's sort of stumbled on the whole summit. And so I think, personally, I'm still on tenterhooks, because there's going to be so much pushback from the Democrats, as Christine mentioned, from the military industrial complex, all the strategists in the CIA, and et cetera, et cetera. So it's a great step forward, but there are all sorts of pitfalls awaiting. Yeah.
What are some of the pitfalls you're concerned about? What are some of those pitfalls that you're concerned about?
Well, there will be various pushbacks. I mean, one of the problems with Trump, I understand, is that he tends to, it's the last person who has his ear. So he will say something today, and then tomorrow he will say something else because somebody has persuaded him. I mean, John Bolton, for instance, is still there on the team.
Yeah, and let's remind everybody, in his position as National Security Advisor, John Bolton is technically the first person to talk to Trump in the morning and the last person to talk to him at night.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's
every day.
But I mean, it's not merely Bolton. There's the whole state that's been built up, the military state, and so many careers, so many jobs, so many contracts for F-35s, and you name it, are at stake. So there's going to be a hell of a lot of opposition. Some that will be vocal, and in other cases, they will just, use the bureaucratic processes to foil what he's said he wants to do. And I think the other problem is that he's got a very short span of attention. So now he's enjoyed his triumph in Singapore. Next week, he may well have rather forgotten about it. So there's another worry.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That's the voice of Tim Beal. He's an expert on East Asian politics, formerly of the Victoria University of Wellington. He's talking to us all the way from New Zealand. Also on the line is Christine Ahn. She's the founder of the International founder and International Coordinator of Women Cross DMZ. And KJ Ngo, our special correspondent, is in studio. KJ.
Yes. So I actually have a question for Tim. Tim, this summit agreement is some of the first steps towards a peace treaty. But, the pundits, and the people who are dismissing this agreement say that a peace treaty cannot be signed until, China is in the picture. Now, of course, we know that there were 19 countries that were involved in the Korean War, and therefore it's highly unlikely that, all 19 are going to come together on the table to sign a peace treaty. So what do you think about the possibilities of a peace treaty?
Well, I think China has obviously a special role, because China was a signatory to the Armistice Agreement. We had the North Korea, China, the United States sort of masquerading as the United Nations, and as you know, South Korea under Syngman Rhee refused to join in those discussions. But I mean, that's past history. So I think if you were to have a peace treaty, those four parties would be the obvious candidates. And don't forget, China's got a very strong interest in peace. So I've got no problems about involving China in that process. It would strengthen the process. Now, personally, I don't think peace treaties are terribly, I mean, they're useful, but there's so much else that you have to take into account. But for a peace treaty, I think, yes, China is an important part of it.
Oh, great, great. And we see that, these are the first steps. I think the peace treaty, once that is put into place, then we can start to move towards the other kinds of actions that are being, talked about, CVID, denuclearization, etc. One of the things which is interesting and which people have been glossing over is that the North Koreans see this as denuclearization of the peninsula, and they've never deviated from that formulation or that phrase, whereas the United States seems to think unilaterally that this is a kind of unilateral disarmament of North Korea, namely the CVID. Anything else you care to say about that?
That's the American way, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Disarmament is unilateral. Arms control is something that other people do, not the United States, and so forth. So this is all sort of par for the course. The denuclearization of the peninsula, I find an awkward phrase, because it's really, it allows the Americans to sort of, American administration, to morph that into unilateral denuclearization of North Korea. But also, where does, in a sense, where does the Korean Peninsula end. Now, the North Koreans have one stage talked about nuclear weapons in the vicinity. So, I mean, that's, again, not terribly useful since nuclear weapons are... come from great distances. I mean, Donald Trump, in his comments on the war games, complained that the B-52s, whatever, were flying from Guam, 6.5 hours away. But, I mean, they can also come, you know, directly from the United States. So there are really no geographical boundaries. So that's, it seems to me, a problem. And I think what we must try and remember that, you know, the business has to be reciprocal if it's going to work, and bear that in mind.
A voice of Tim Beale. He is from New Zealand University in Wellington, I guess, named after a British queen. Is it Victoria University? His books were published by Pluto Press, the ones referred to at his introduction. North Korea, The Struggle Against American Power, was published in 2005, and then 2011, Crisis in Korea, America, China, and the Risk of War. Also heard was Christine Ahn, not Hong, A-H-N. They're both, those Christines are with the Korea Policy Institute, KPI. I'm going to investigate Tim Beale some more. That's Tim Beale, B-E-A-L, all lowercase, .net.nz for New Zealand is his personal website. I guess he's emeritus from Victoria University. Well, it's turning 11 o'clock by a clock here. The computer doesn't say 11 yet, so opinions are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station. Management, Board of Directors, WEFT Associates. And go to the WEFT calendar, WEFT PSAs.